Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Mike Kresnick, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune and Pastor Dusty White of Corumdale Church and Pastor Chris Hummelman of First City Church. Every Wednesday, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're continuing our conversation on Senator Ben Sasse's book, The Vanishing American Adult.
Mike thought we should just invite Senator Sasse to join us for the podcast. I told Mike, I'm not sure that our listenership is at the place where a sitting senator would come and join us, but I like the courage of that ask.
If you share this podcast with your friends, leave us nice reviews on iTunes, maybe Ben Sasse would be willing to come.
Senator, if you're listening, we'd love to get your thoughts on your own book.
He does tweet a lot, so maybe he'll tweet about it.
All right, so this podcast is going to have basically four parts. If you didn't listen to last week's, you'll probably need it just to catch up on where we are. But I want to look at, I want to have a few minutes talking about Sasse's chapter on education, a few minutes talking about his chapter on consumption, a few minutes talking about his chapter on travel, and then some of the critiques of the book that we've come across. So those are sort of the four sections that we'll talk about in this podcast. First of all, So Sasse sets up the problem. Hey, we're not generating adults who know how to be competent citizens and independent, self-reliant people. And the first chapter of sort of his "What Should We Do About That?" Is titled "More School Isn't Enough." And here's the interesting thing. I think this is a very interesting chapter. Obviously, as an educator, I'm interested in anything related to school, having started a school and having been thinking about sort of philosophy of education issues a lot. I think Sasse is very measured in this chapter, meaning he comes across very not heavy-handed about any one model of education. Because here's what's funny to me, like as a pastor, right, all the fights about education are, well, should I homeschool my kids or public school or private school? Like that's the only conversation people ever want to ask is, you know, well, are you guys a homeschool church? Are you a public school church? Which form of education are you going to most get behind? Sasse says, can we just ask a different question? Like whatever the form you're pursuing is, can we ask the question, what is education? Hmm. Which is great because he says, schooling and education are not the same thing. What Americans are sort of consumed with is schooling. Like, how should we school kids? Hmm. But let's admit that education is what matters. And education, he says, education requires curiosity. You can teach really young kids just because they're pliable and willing to learn. But kids hit a point where if they're not personally interested in what they're studying, you can't make them you can't educate them because they have to have a personal stake in what they're learning. And so I think his chapter on education is fascinating because he basically says, look, everybody in America agrees our public schools are not doing the job, but everybody keeps wanting to make the answer, let's throw more money at them or more teachers at them or more administrators at them or, you know,
more homework.
Yeah. Let's keep doing what we're doing, only sort of double down on whatever aspect of it seems like it's broken. And he's saying, man, we need a whole nationwide conversation about what is education in the first place and how can we get really aggressive about all kinds of models that just will get us back to the roots of helping kids get excited about learning and excited about curiosity.
Bob, just for the heck of it, can you give a condensed version of what he's doing here as a historian when he walks through Dewey and just some of that history?
I'll do my best. You know, he mentions that the most significant figure in American thinking about education is John Dewey, he's the most famous person in American educational thinking. And he does a better job, I think, than anyone explaining what John Dewey was about and what he thought. And essentially, John Dewey's vision was that John Dewey was a little bit of like a social engineer. In other words, he wanted to rebuild society. And Dewey's vision was the school, not the family, needs to be primary. And so he really saw schooling as a replacement for family. He basically said, if we can get all the kids in a country in schools, then the school can become the primary place of formation and development. And he had a very sort of a little bit utopian and pretty heavy-handed understanding of the school and its role in society in shaping kids. Sasse, unsurprisingly, is pretty opposed to that and says, no, we don't want schools that replace the family. We don't want schools that seek to replace the family. We want schools that further the job of parents, which is raising and training future adults who are competent citizens and whatnot. So anyways, he chronicles Dewey, and then he talks about some of the critics of public education from both the right and left. So I think he's very balanced in saying, obviously, you're going to have critics who don't like public education, but you also have critics who are very liberal and say, yeah, public education is fine, but here's where it's broken. And so he surveys some of the critiques. And then again, he doesn't prescribe a solution in terms of a form of education. He just says, let's have a completely different conversation. We need to be doing something different with kids. Here's a few quotes. I'm suggesting that we should be having a completely different conversation. Instead of spending our energy building hermetically sealed bubbles in which to protect our adolescents, we should be building in advance the kinds of experimental tools that we hope to persuade them to ask for, without them even realizing that we were orchestrating affairs to get them to discover their need. I believe the increasing institutionalization of the teenage years has made many young Americans less like citizens and more like cogs in a machine. More time in a bureaucratic setting means less family life, less time in the community, and less effort invested in thinking about what coming-of-age work experiences could and should look like. Too much formalized schooling inevitably crowds out communities of the heart and soul. Voluntarism, flexibility and choice, cross-cultural experiences, exertion, success and failure, and time. Essentially everything for becoming a fully formed adult. So he's pressing us to ask, is what we're even trying to do with education the right thing? You hear him saying, man, it crowds out opportunities to travel, opportunities to learn work habits, opportunities to volunteer in the community. I think he's arguing for a little more of a well-rounded vision of less formal schooling, more holistic education.
So what does this look like for the parent at home? I think there's obviously policy implications here and how we try to structure school, or maybe we want to fight for certain ways of doing schooling, but just regardless of where you're, what type of schooling your kid does at this point, just set that aside for a second. How are Ben Sasse's words helpful for the parents in the way you engage your kids' schooling? What would you guys think as those with kids?
I mean, my short, quick answer would be schooling's one helpful way to educate your children, but it's only one of the ways that you should be educating your children.
I'll just quote from page 81. The intended argument of this book is against the mindless assumption made by too many of us that schools and their teachers can awaken all of our kids alone inside just one institutional form. Rather, all of us need to be more engaged at helping spark these awakenings. So I think he's saying, instead of outsourcing education to the school, parents have to be personally involved in sparking curiosity and awakening in their kids. And if parents are doing that, your kids are going to do great in school. I mean, every public school teacher will tell you that. The kids that are most motivated in the classroom are kids whose parents are involved. They're building curiosity. They're reading with their kids. Those are always the kids who are good learners. And he's saying we have to stop outsourcing schooling to the schools and instead see the whole society as part of sparking awakening in kids.
And this word, this curiosity, that's huge to me in the sense that so often education it gets reduced to this pragmatic sense of like, okay, what's going to help me take this class to help me graduate, to help me get this job. And it sort of narrows education into this very uber pragmatic. I only need to learn what is going to be useful for a job.
Yep.
Rather than just the idea of learning, like the life, the world, existence is this wonderfully rich, robust, curious, crazy thing. And that we want to encourage kids just to have this sense of awe and wonder.
Yeah.
And so opening that up, which does have pragmatic purposes.
Yeah.
Like there is definitely it's going to lead to, you know, good benefits. But that's how I think of, like, the way I was raised was, there's so much wonder in life. Just go explore it. Go see it. Go experience it. And that certainly helped me in school.
Yeah. Agreed. All right. The next section, let's jump to a different part here. His chapter on consumption. And his essential argument is we need to be building producers instead of consumers.
Hmm.
and our society builds consumers. In fact, all of marketing and advertising and capitalism is built on getting you to be a consumer, getting you to need and want and consume. And he says, you know, this is affecting how we shape kids to think about their lives. It's why kids seem to turn everything into a need. I need a new iPhone. I need a car. I need a, you know, whatever. I need air conditioning. That's one of his jokes. And he said, my kids told me one day that they needed air conditioning, and I almost lost my mind and told them, no, you don't need, you want air conditioning. It's nice, but it's not a need. People have lived without it for thousands of years. So it's a really helpful chapter. By the way, if you've never thought about like the ways, if you go back to our podcast with Jamie Smith and how he talks about cultural liturgies and the liturgies of consumption, I think SaaS actually does a pretty effective job sort of bringing those to the surface for us and helping us see, gosh, we are taught to consume at every level. I mean, all of our lives, our whole society economically is built around consumption. And again, as I think back to my great grandparents and reading their story, it's very much about, like, there's a story in my great-grandparents' chronology where they had to choose between getting new shoes for their kids or buying this piece of farm equipment that was really going to increase their ability to make revenue, but it was a huge expense. And so they talked about it as a family and decided, all right, well, the kids are going without new shoes. And so the kids literally took, like, you know, random stuff that they could find and like made it into shoes that they could wear for the summer so that they could buy this piece of farm equipment and learn to go without. And then the next year, of course, that new piece of farm equipment increased their revenue and they were able to buy a nice pair of shoes. But it's just like my kids have never had to make a trade-off like that. And I'm sort of sad about that because that's a really valuable moment and learning experience to realize, gosh, producing, contributing something to the world is really important and is more fulfilling than consumption.
Dusty, that's why I don't buy new shoes all the time.
Yeah, because I'll just give them to you.
Because you'll just give them to me, but I'm just trying to be resourceful.
So even, so to tie these two concepts together with the education and the consumption, I mean, even many of our motivations for being educated have to do with consumption. Yeah. I want an education so I can have a good job, so I can purchase and have the luxuries and be able to do all of these things. So even how we are motivated to become educated rather than what does it look like for me to contribute, learn, and part of that and underneath that is to contribute to society and serve society and create a better place.
Here's the most fascinating quote in this chapter to me. The deep truth is that work, not money, is the fundamental source of our dignity. And that alone, I think, is worth the price of the book to me, because I think where we've flipped it is to say money is the source of my, like, my work is about making a certain income, and that freedom to spend that and to consume things is what makes my life meaningful. And so I want the most money that I can have or the best job that I can have so that I can consume, so that I can sort of set up the life that I want for myself. Mm-hmm. He's saying, no, it's actually work that gives you a sense of dignity. And that's a crucial insight, I think, especially if you think about why are so many people in America sort of struggling with anxiety, depression, malaise, despair. Like, we're the most affluent society in history, but also probably the least fulfilled, the least satisfied. Why is that? Well, it's because we've replaced sort of income with work as this source of our dignity. Hmm. Here's Sass, the historian, speaking to you about consumption. Hard work produces wealth, which then produces leisure. Over an individual lifetime, this seems both fair and good. But across generations, it leads to people who know only the leisure and not the work or character that created it. Yeah. That's the difference between me and my great-grandparents right there. So, again, he's just saying our culture is at a place where we have the affluence that we can know only the leisure but not the work, and that's a significant problem for us. Mm-hmm. So, consume less. If you're looking for one thoughtful chapter, this chapter I think is worth the price of the book, just the way it will help you think about your patterns of consumption and what it might mean to sort of try to disentangle yourselves from that. All right, third topic, travel. He has this really fascinating chapter on travel where he just says, you need to travel. And travel is part of becoming, and I was reading this to my wife because he was like talking about like sending your kid on the subway when they're like 10. You know, it's just like, you need to have your kids like go on meaningful excursions, even if it's just going down to the park by themselves or going to the grocery store, like
adventure. Kids are going to get abducted.
Yeah, that's what I fear too. Yeah, I mean, that's why we don't do it. It's because, like, oh man, the world's dangerous. But he says, hey, this is part of like growing up. Is this like, remember the first time you went somewhere without your parents and it felt like sort of like, oh man, they're trusting me with some freedom and some responsibility. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of, you know, kind of exciting and adventurous, and I have to learn things for myself.
He says the traveler finds the larger world, but also his or her own. So there's something about traveling and being in a different space that makes you start to realize even some of your interior life, I think is what he's getting at there.
And what I appreciated about this too is he says it's not so much where you travel, but how you travel.
Yes.
Because traveling can be expensive. And yeah, it's like, oh, how am I supposed to send my kid overseas? And it's more about how you engage that. And again, not in a consumptive kind of passive, I'm all about just the pleasure here, but to grow, to learn, to experience new things and develop and create that sense of, you know, being connected to other people, empathy, you know, all the benefits of a good expanded experience that helps you mature.
Well, he has this fascinating point about we've replaced travel with tourism.
Yeah.
Which tourism is basically paying someone else to take you to the places they think you should see, which is an economic incentive to a city, sure. But doesn't help you learn anything. He's like the more interesting, fascinating, and frugal way to travel is just to just go on your own and go to the places that are interesting to you.
Figure it out. Yeah.
So tourism is the expensive part, right? It's where you're paying a lot of money to go to places versus, I remember when I was in high school, a senior in high school, my friend Chris and I both wanted to go visit Bradley University, in Peoria, Illinois. And so we, talked with our parents and just decided we're going to take a couple days off school and we're going to drive over there. So just Chris and I mean, we're like 17 years old, 16 years old. I don't know. Got the car, drove to Peoria, Illinois, and we were like, well, as long as we're in Peoria, we might as well go to Chicago because it's pretty close, and Chicago's kind of a cool big city. So, like, I remember going to Chicago for the first time as a 16-year-old kid, and just, like, I didn't even know where to go in the city. I was just like, let's just go walk around downtown. I guess this is what people do, you know? And so just that, like, finding your own way in a huge city, experiencing, like, how nobody would look you in the eye because it's, like, a big city where, like, you don't look people in the eye. You'd look down at the sidewalk and walk, and, you know, it was just a fascinating experience, but it was very much, like, oh, I got to figure this out for myself. And there's like excitement and adventure in that. It didn't cost me much at all. It cost us gas. And I think we slept on the floor of a friend's place somewhere in Illinois. And I mean, it was dirt cheap, but it was a fun experience.
Yeah. That reminds me of, so two things that two thoughts that kind of prompt on this chapter. One, so when I was in high school, went on a senior trip to Europe, and it was very touristy. I mean, we had a tour guide, we had a bus, like everything was planned out for us. And it was great. It was fun, but it was kind of sterile. It was, you know, it was exactly what you would expect a senior class trip to Europe to be. When I was like my second year of teaching, so taught at a small private Christian school that year, the senior class was three guys, it was three dudes. And so for their trip that year, we just got in a car and drove to New York City.
Wow.
And we had a connection. So we stayed in a church in the basement of an old church in Queens, like the Corona section of Queens.
Oh,
so it was,
wow.
And we just got on it, walked a couple blocks to the train station, got on the train and just went into Manhattan, went to different parts of New York and just did that, walked around, did whatever we wanted. I mean, and respectfully, but it was fun just hanging out with these guys. And I mean, I was a young teacher. I was only like 5 or 6 years older than them. And it was a completely different experience because it wasn't sterile. It wasn't planned. We probably walked down some streets and neighborhoods and we're like, okay, we probably don't want to be here at night, you know, like, and so you felt and you experienced like New York City in a very different way. And when Mindy and I lived in DC, we would do this with, when we have friends and family come visit us, like the first time there, it's like, all right, let's go do the tourist stuff because you got to see it. But if people came back second or third time, we enjoyed taking them to just hanging out, like this is what it's like to live here. This is what
this is where the locals
go. Yeah, this is where the locals go, or just let them kind of experience that kind of stuff to kind of expand. Hey, this is real DC. This isn't sterile white marble, you know, monument DC. And people, they appreciated that because it felt like this is real life and kind of that experience.
What about traveling with your kids?
Yeah.
Does he talk about that?
Yeah, it's a fascinating chapter to read. And it made me realize, Chris, back to your thing of like, I just always say, I'm not going to travel anywhere because it's expensive. But it made me realize like, if I had a more adventurous spirit that just said, well, how can I do it cheap? I would probably travel a lot more. You know, he talks about just taking a backpack and, you know, taking whatever you can carry. Mm. You know, people do this all the time after college, just backpack through Europe or whatever. I went to Russia and, you know, backpacked my way over there. And, So yeah, doing it with kids or as a family, I think there's a lot more creativity that I was inspired to after reading this chapter of like, oh, I could probably be traveling a lot more and giving my kids a lot more experiences that aren't expensive, that don't cost thousands of dollars, but that would get them a different experience in a different place that sort of awakens different kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really helpful to think about traveling outside of consuming. I was actually shocked when I first picked up the book to realize that he was talking about how you need to travel right after he talked about how you need to not consume. Because for me, travel is luxury.
Yeah.
And I've always had it in that category. And so it's pretty helpful for me to just realize, oh, actually it doesn't have to be luxurious. It doesn't have to be expensive. It can just be an experience. So he's saying, go see the world because you have limited time.
All right, fourth topic. Let's respond to some critiques, or let's engage some critiques of this book. Not everyone loves this book. Not everyone loves Ben Sasse, unsurprisingly. He's a political figure. You know, such are polarizing. I read some article from some East Coast journalist who was basically like Ben Sasse is intolerable. He's always telling everybody these high-minded ideals of who they should be. It's just annoying. And so not everyone loves Ben. He gets a lot of crap on Twitter for wearing Nebraska gear and
he's a wrestler
having teeth that aren't perfectly straight and stuff like that. So he's got a thick skin. He's got a thick skin.
He's a wrestler. He seems like weak things to.
It's Twitter, man.
Be bashing people.
It's like, but how cool, like, to see pictures of him on Twitter, like sitting in like shorts and a running shirt, all sweaty,
exactly.
outside
the Capitol,
talking to who was the other senator, smoking a cigarette. Like, they're just like hanging out. It's like he's like a normal guy. Like.
Yeah. It was helpful for me in the book to realize that his dad was his wrestling coach.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, that makes a lot of sense. You weren't like a lineman.
Yeah.
It wasn't really about a team situation. It was about you going in there and winning.
He tells a great story about when he beat his dad in wrestling for the first time, which is a fun. You should read it. It's a good story. Good coming of age moment. So, Mike, you read a critique of this that you wanted to share.
Yeah, here's the here's one paragraph from an article I read critiquing Sasse's book here. Suppose adulthood were not synonymous with independence, not synonymous with working, not synonymous with grit or with achievement. Suppose adulthood is instead about accepting dependence, that you can't take care of everything on your own, that you have limits. Suppose the story we need is not the one about the worker who always says yes, but the person who's willing to say no to the boss, to the job, to work. If we are heading into the post-work future, then the solution is not to double down on the American worship of work, but to build a future in which the American adult can exist with or without it. There have been other spheres, the domestic, to pick one not entirely random example, in which people have been able to cultivate virtue, derive identity, and contribute to society. But work is going away. It's not coming back. It's time for us to face that future, which is to say, it's time to grow up. What do you guys have to say about that?
Category mistake.
Ooh.
Is what I have to say. Like, in my mind, that's a writer looking for an article to write because he needs something to critique. Like, honestly, I don't know who the writer is, and I you know, maybe good for me to read the article. But in other words, I don't think what that writer is saying and what Sasse is saying are mutually exclusive. I don't think it's true that if we lean into independence, self-reliance, and the need for meaningful work, that means we don't also embrace dependence and the need for rest.
Hmm.
I think there's a both and there. And I think Sasse would say that too. I think what Sasse's concern is to say, it's not biblical Sabbath rest that our culture is embracing. Mm-hmm. It's laziness and apathy and lack of responsibility. And so only when we embrace independence and work will we also experience the fruitfulness of rest and acknowledging our creatureliness, our dependence, our need for rest and sleep and leisure and all those things. And so it just feels like a thin critique, honestly, to me.
Yeah, because if the writer of this article is suggesting that Sasse's argument is we need a deeper self-reliance, a deeper sense of that independent spirit, that kind of that rugged individualism that can kind of pull us away from community or make us self-centered and selfish and, you know, pull me up by my bootstraps, that kind of ethic that can go too far at times. Mm-hmm. I mean, I read through this book and I'm like, I don't get that sense at all from what he is saying. In fact, it seems that he's really calling people to adulthood and maturity in order that they can be more engaged corporately and communally. Like he definitely has a communal concern here I think independence is the way the writer of the article is using the term independence. I think Sasse is calling for a maturity.
Yeah.
It would, which, so again, a category error here.
It's interesting that it fits to me in the paradigm of Edwin Friedman in Failure of Nerve, which the point he makes is you have to have healthy self-differentiation before you can be a meaningful part of a community. You have to first learn independence before dependence even makes sense, because otherwise you're just enmeshed. Otherwise you're codependent, right? Like, what's the difference between codependence and healthy dependence? It's I've learned how to be myself and be an individual, and I've embraced my need for society, community, friendship, right? Mm-hmm. So it just feels like this is, especially if we think of Sass's book as like a guide to child rearing or a guide to, you know, raising mature, healthy citizens. I don't think it excludes dependence. I just think it has to start with helping people have a sense of healthy independence and self-reliance that probably is going to have some messiness to it. Like, you know, your kid when he's 20 is going to think he knows everything, and that's okay, because by the time he's 30, he'll figure out he doesn't, you know, and that's the story of all of us, right?
Yeah, yeah. I'm thinking in terms biblically too. So God gives us dominion and authority over things, right? But there seems to be in the Genesis account, Adam kind of learning that and practicing that, and we too have to learn that and practice that. And so there is this sense of like, no, we are going someplace. We are trying to grow to a spot where we can properly exercise dominion and authority while also understanding our proper place within the created order.
Right. And this is the doctrine of salvation too, right? We are each individually called to salvation in Christ, and yet we are one body. So there's this unique individual element of self-identity union with Christ, and there's also this corporate solidarity of I'm part of God's people, and those two things aren't in conflict with each other.
It's good.
All right, well, the book is called The Vanishing American Adult, again, written by Ben Sass, published earlier this year by St. Martin's Press. Fruitful and I think an insightful read if you're looking for something to read this summer, something to take with you on vacation or to the lake or to sit out in the backyard when the weather's nice.
To travel with?
Yeah, to travel
fit
with.
My backpack?
Fit in your backpack. Yeah. It might be a little heavy depending on your weight requirements, but I would suggest it. It's a good read and a thought-provoking read. We'll get Ben Sass on the podcast at some point in the future. Senator, please, if you're listening, reach out to us. Hit me up on Twitter. We'd love to have you.
The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or church leader in another context, we thank you for listening in, and we pray that the things that we've talked about might also be helpful to you as you minister in your own context. If you've read Ben Sass's book or want to give us topic suggestions, shoot us an email, podcast@cdomaha.com. And we hope that you join us next Wednesday for another Wednesday conversation.
If Bob Thune and Ben Sass wrestled, who would win?
He would kill me.
Yeah, he's
actually a wrestler. I'm faster. I could run away.